On Consumer Protection to order, please. It's Monday, April 9th, 2007. Got a few bills on our agenda today, and I think we're going to attempt them in order. So with that, I'm going to open a
first
public hearing on House Bill 2983. So, first up, believe it or not, Tom Gallagher, Marty King, and Daryl Fuller. Monty King, excuse me.
Marty,
sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Auto Dealers. I think I understand, having talked to the sponsor of the bill, what this bill is about. I'd like to just give a couple of brief introductory remarks and then talk a second about the bill. The auto dealers have a program called AutoCap, which we, in agreement with some other members, are going to expand in the near future. AutoCap is a voluntary program run by the auto dealers, which we hire a third-party consultant to take complaints and to work those complaints out with the dealership at the request and at no cost to the person who files the complaint. We're going to expand that program, put signage in the dealerships, and at the sale signing, when you sign all the documents, there'll be another form in there notifying them about this program called AutoCap. The reason we do this is to begin to build a little bit better customer relationships and customer goodwill, and to give people a place to go at no cost to themselves to deal with some of these complaints that they have after the sale is made. There are other legal recourses they have, which are somewhat difficult, voluntary arbitration, attorney general, and so forth. I don't think those are the best ways for people to get their recovery here, so AutoCap will fill part of that void. This bill has some troubles, some big troubles with it for us if you were to go forward with it, and let me take those in a bit of an order. When you drive off the lot in a car, a lot of things happen. As soon as you drive away, you're no longer in the same position. Factory warranties will come into play. The value of the car changes. There are insurance questions. Who covers the car at the time they drive away? And if they bring it back, what happens to the damage to the car in the intervening time? So the concept of being able to just bring a car back, as it's explained in this bill, and pay a daily rental fee is not a very fair valuation process, because that car will have changed. Just put the question this way. If you went in to get a car and they said, well, it's a brand new car, but it's, don't tell you it's been previously owned and don't tell you it's been off the lot for 3 days, would you think you were buying a brand new car? And I think that's kind of the criteria that we expect every consumer to have. If you've entered into a deal and driven away with the car, it's no longer a new car. I understand the problem with minors, and they're dealing with in a very expensive transaction like this. I think in some cases, in almost all cases, before somebody drives away, they have to have credit, which means they have to have credit worthiness and they have to have a credit history, a residence and a place to live. They're out there able to buy a $15,000 to $40,000 car, even if they're under 21, because somebody's willing to extend them credit, or they have a co-signer or something like that. So it's not just an easy way of driving into a new car dealership and driving out with your new car. It isn't just a simple matter. If you look at this bill in a different way, as to ways that we could avoid going through the rescission process, then you'd be putting on restrictions on the person who's buying the car. You'd be turning to someone who was under 21, who may have a family, may be working, may have plenty of value to buy a new car, but you'd saying, well, you can't have the car for a couple of days, you can't take it, you have to take your time to really think about whether you want to buy the car. I'm not sure that's the direction you'd want to go. The last thing I'll say is about buyer's remorse for a second. There are two or three kinds of buyers out there. There are those people who found a better deal. They can be 18, 19, 20 years old, and they want to bring this car back and get the better deal. There can be people out there that are simply playing the purchasing game. They're 18, 19, 20-year-old. They're not all being taken advantage of, and I don't know how you separate the two. I'm saying there's some that are less talented and less skilled in a major credit purchase like this. If you decide to move this bill forward, there are a number of amendments we would have to bring to the bill and urge on you. I'm hoping that what you do is you take a look at the way we're trying to deal on the new car side with our dealers, the way we're trying to deal with this voluntary program that they can use called AutoCap, and hope that that would take care of a person like Representative Clem's constituent, who a day or so after she bought the car felt that this wasn't the right thing for her to have done. In this case, she could have called and she could have gotten help from an independent third party to try and undo the deal without opening it up to everybody who might be a shrewd buyer and might be trying to play with the value of the car. I'll let my friends talk and take questions anytime you want, Mr. Chair.
You and we'll listen to all three of you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Monty King. I'm president of Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association. We represent used car dealers, have a couple new ones, too. And I also work for Oregon Power Sports Association, which is new and used trailers, RVs, cycles, and boat dealers. In 1999, I introduced and got passed a bill requiring education for independent dealers, non-franchise dealers. Since then, it's been approximately 65,000 hours of education to vehicle dealers, not the franchise dealers. In pre-licensing, we've had almost 2,000 people, that's my estimate, go through pre-licensing education of 8 hours before they can get their dealer license. So we've had a lot of education in the industry about how to sell, what the rights are, Department of Justice rules, advertising, everything else. It's been a real change in the industry. And sales in the last 7 years are up. But we've seen complaints come down since 1997. Like for a while, car dealers dropped off the DOJ list after they split them up as far as new and used and all those, and they dropped off, then they put them all back together, and then they got back on the top 10 list again. But overall, the complaints are down, but sales are up. There's a federal as-is requirement because used car dealers are basically recyclers. All of these vehicles have been used before by somebody else, and the dealer doesn't know everything about every car, and nobody can. And I know it's hard to believe, but sometimes the consumers come in and try and get rid of their really bad cars to dealers, and they hide stuff, and we don't always know. A good question is, would you lend your car to an 18-year-old? You.
I did.
I don't think you would. And it's kind of the feeling that, you know, if you want to rewrite the bill so it's to everybody, every private party, when you sell your car, you've got to give them 3 days to bring it back. That would be fair. I don't think it would be very smart, but it would be fair. We have the toughest advertising laws in the United States, as far as I know, as far as what you can advertise, how you can advertise, whether things are free, about telling the truth to the consumer. We went through and changed the bond from $15,000 to $40,000. The industry did this, not the consumer groups. We not only moved it from $15,000 to $40,000, but we capped the dealer-to-dealer or bank-to-dealer or auction-to-dealer limit at $20,000. So only consumers can go after the last $20,000, the top $20,000. Consumers can go after the whole $40,000. But certainly a dealer-to-dealer problem is not going to go over $20,000. How long does it take to know an 18-year-old did something to the car he brought back? Sometimes, I mean, you're not going to know he really wrung that car out for a week or two. How are you going to prove that they wrung it out? My wife and I, a number of years back, sold her little Porsche 924, which is, and 2 weeks later, the kid who bought it, who was 19 years old, came back and he wanted us to give him his money back, and he also had given us a little Ford Escort wagon because he blew the engine out of the Porsche. Okay, he got a big settlement and he bought a Porsche, a motorcycle, and a boat the same weekend. Well, maybe he shouldn't have done that, but we weren't going to give the kid his money back and take a Porsche with a blown engine back. And we told him, we kind of figured what was happening. We told him before he bought it, this is not a race car. Don't go out and run this thing top end because it's not going to last. It's already 10, 12 years old. If you do this, the Kerber problem gets worse. Kerbers are illegal dealers. They're out there. They're hiding as consumers. So people who would normally get a dealer's license if this passes, they're not going to get dealer's license anymore. They're just going to hide among the weeds and keep taking advantage of people. We've been fighting that for years and years and years. And anybody who's been in the legislature very long knows the bills I put in over the last 8 years trying to deal with the problem. If a consumer has a problem, they can go to OADA. They can go to OIEDA. They can go to OVDA. I have been doing consumer complaints for years, and we almost always take care of the problems. And I will commit to you that we will have a place on the website where somebody can complain. And for our almost 400 members, we'll make sure the dealers know that they can send people to us also if they have complaints. The consumer can go to Department of Justice. They can call their lawyer. There's plenty of places where a bad deal can get taken care of, where a consumer has to go to get help. If we're going to do anything with a bill, let's wipe it out and let's talk about moving Business Regulation Office out of DMV into a separate arm so we can actually take a look at how deals are sold, except instead of just how a vehicle is titled and registered and the problems associated with that. There are about 2,200 total dealers in the state. I think about probably 1,900 of them are independent, or I think 1,600 independent. The other ones are some kind of franchise. I don't think this bill is a good idea. I know I don't want to give my personal car to somebody for 3 days. And I don't think any dealer would want to also.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller with the Oregon Independent Auto Dealers Association. It seems to me this legislation asks you to consider two different issues. One is whether or not somebody who's between the ages of 18 and not quite 21 is capable of making a high-dollar decision on their own, or whether they need special protection under the law. The second question that I think you need to explore in looking at this bill is whether or not there is something specific or special about an auto purchase that is different than any other kind of purchase that somebody between 18 and less than 21 would make, because you're making those two policy judgments in the legislation. I'm not sure that I would agree that somebody who is over 18 and less than 21 is in a less capable position to make a financial decision than somebody who's over 21. I'm not aware of any evidence or any study that indicates that somebody who's over 18 and less than 21 who purchases a car makes a poorer decision than the rest of the population. In the absence of any sort of evidence that there's actually a problem there, I question whether or not there needs to be a state policy that we don't believe these people are as capable as the rest of us. So I'm not quite sure, other than maybe some anecdotal evidence, if there's any real evidence out there that problem exists. Assuming that you could prove a problem like that does exist, why are we limiting it to cars? A person under this bill could buy a boat, and they wouldn't have 3 days. They could buy a car, and they would.
They could buy a $1,500 car and put a $4,000 stereo in it. They would have 3 days to return the car, but they don't necessarily have any time to return the stereo. So if our concern is the cost of the purchase for somebody who's under that age, it would seem to me that the committee ought to have a discussion about setting a dollar threshold as opposed to a specific product threshold. And that's assuming that you can find some evidence that people that are under 21 and over 18 somehow are less capable than the rest of us, which, again, I'm not aware of any evidence that suggests that there's a problem with that age group. This is my 20th anniversary in this legislative process. This is the first time I've heard testimony on a bill where there's been no proponents that have come up and testified. When the witness sheet went up, I think there were only opposition to the bill. And so we have substantial concerns about whether or not any of the two tests, if you will, that I think ought to be met before legislation like this moves forward has actually been met, and would encourage you to not move the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee. Representative Gerard.
Quick question, just to bring me up to speed. You mentioned 18 as the cutoff, kind of the low-end cutoff. What prevents someone from 16 or even younger than 18 from purchasing a car today?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, my belief is you have to be 18 years old in order to be able to legally sign a document.
To borrow money, or is that to enter the contract?
Yeah, to legally enter into a contract, I believe you have to be 18 years old. And the 21 being a special number, the only other thing I can think of at the 21 level is you're not able to drink until you're 21.
I saw that was the definition of minor in this bill, and it kind of threw me a little bit for a loop.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Fuller, I share your concern about not hearing from any proponent. So I don't know the reason for this particular, I know it was a constituent of Representative Clem's, the reason for the request for the bill, if it was some sort of buyer's remorse or some other issue. But not knowing that puts us in sort of a difficult situation. But I wonder, when I read it, I thought, well, this can't possibly be meant to apply to new cars, because, of course, the value goes down when the car leaves the lot. So I see a used car, new car distinction. But I wonder if your position would be different if there was still a three-day right of rescission, but the car didn't leave the lot until the end of the 3 days.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, we would still have a concern about that simply because you're going to require every auto dealer in the state of Oregon to partition off part of their dealership to warehouse cars for 3 days that they can't sell, and that they can't put cars that are available for sale on that. We have a space problem like almost every other business does. We have to be real careful about where we put vehicles. So whether it's a three-day right of rescission for just people between 18 and under 21, or there's a bill on the Senate side that would be create a three-day right of rescission for all dealers, in that case, because if a car is traded in, we also have to hold that traded-in vehicle for the 3 days. So if an 18- or 19-year-old brings us their traded-in vehicle and they purchase a vehicle, we have to hold that trade-in. We can't do anything with it under current law until that 3 days were to expire, if you were to add a three-day right of rescission. So all of those traded-in vehicles would have to be locked up and insured and protected until the clock has run out. Now, if you add a provision that, well, they can buy the car, but they can't take it with them for 3 days, they got 3 days to decide, now we have to hold their trade-in and we have to hold their purchase. So you're doubling up the number of cars that potentially we would have to find space to put them that would lock that space out for sales purposes. And I would suggest to you that that's a pretty significant burden, especially on smaller dealers.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony today. Appreciate it. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on House Bill 2983? So it is true, no proponents. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2983 and open a hearing on House Bill 3081. First up, I'd like to have Neil Jackson, please.
Good
Yeah, Steve, why don't you go ahead and give us a brief preview of the bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Holvey. House Bill 3081 eliminates the provisions under which a motor vehicle liability insurer is responsible to a second insurer or insured.
Thank you. And if you could introduce yourself and the organization you're representing, if any, for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm on the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, here to speak in support of House Bill 3081. In order to make it understandable to the committee members, I'd like to go through what happens when each of you buy a policy of motor vehicle insurance to protect you and your family. You will get a standard sheet, which is called a declaration page, and that's usually the first page of your policy. And what that sheet does is it breaks down the amount of coverage you have for each type of coverage that is required under state law, and if you purchase additional coverages, those are broken down, and it breaks down the amount of premium you pay for each of those coverages. Usually the first listed coverage is liability insurance, and under state law, the minimum amount you can purchase is $25,000 per person, with a maximum of $50,000 per accident. Generally, the next thing that is listed, which you pay a premium for, is PIP, personal injury protection. And the minimum amount that you can buy in this state is $15,000. And over to the right of the amount that is listed on the amount that you've purchased will be the cost of that premium. Another coverage that you will purchase will be property damage coverage. And what that does is if you damage someone else's property and it's your fault, whatever coverage you bought, the minimum is 10, then there's that much available for your insurance company to pay off the person with the damaged property. You pay a premium for that. Also listed on your declaration sheet will be UM/UIM coverage. Sometimes it's spelled out. UM is uninsured motorist coverage, which is coverage that is mandated, and it is required for the situation where someone who does not have an insurance policy negligently crashes into you, causes your car damage, causes you injury. You then, obviously, your choice is to go after the person, and generally, if they don't have coverage, it's because they don't have anything. So the purpose of uninsured coverage is you can make a claim against your own policy for your UM limits, and most times they're the same as your liability limits, so we're talking $25,50. And the other situation is where it wouldn't apply on a $25,50 policy, but if you bought more insurance, let's say you bought $50 per person, $100 per accident, and you were hit by someone who only had $25,50 coverage, what you could then do, if your claim was worth more than $25,000, you could go to the person who was at fault, claim the $25,000 that's available under their liability policy. You could then go to your own policy and claim up to $50,000 coverage on your own policy. Now, as I've gone through this, it sounds like we know exactly what we've purchased because it's right there in front of us. Unfortunately, that is not the case, because under Oregon law, what happens is we've already said we've got $25 per person, $50 per accident, and we have $15,000 minimum coverage for personal injury protection. That's to pay your medical bills. What happens is, let's say you got hit by somebody with the same amount of coverage, $25,50. You got hurt. Your medical bills equal $15,000, which your PIP paid for. Your company paid it under your PIP coverage. You think, okay, fine, I can go against the person that hurt me, and I can make a claim for the $25,000, and that includes everything. That includes what we call pain and suffering, the medical bills, everything, and I can be made whole by the other person's $25,000 policy. Well, you can't. Because what happens is you have to pay back your PIP carrier the $15,000 that they paid for your medical bills. So instead of getting the $25,000 that you thought you paid for on your own policy and the $15,000 PIP that you thought you paid for, you get $10,000 coverage that you can make claim to because you've had to pay back the $15,000. Likewise, let's take another scenario. Let's say the same coverages, $25,50 with $15,000 PIP. Let's assume you also have a private health care plan, and that plan is obligated to pick up payments that are not paid that for your treatment for injuries that you sustain. So let's take this scenario where your PIP carrier has paid $15,000 of your medical bills, but you've got a $9,900 bill outstanding that has not been paid. In other words, your total medical bills are $24,900. Your health care plan comes in and pays the $9,900. Again, you think, I can go and claim the $25,000 that is available from the other driver. You got to pay back the $15,000 to your PIP carrier, and you got to pay back the $9,900 that your health carrier paid, which means you net $100. What this bill does is it eliminates the payback requirements. It is our position that when you buy this coverage, you ought to get this coverage, and it should not be. We see it as a game of cards here, or three-card Monte. You think you've got this coverage when you look at your deck sheet, but if you've got to pay all this back, what are you really paying those premiums for? What you're doing is paying in advance for a loan from your own insurance company, and that's all you're getting for that. And it also applies if you're hit by an underinsured person, because again, $15,000 your PIP carrier pays, I'm sorry, uninsured person. Your PIP pays $15,000, the person who hit you has no insurance. Your medical care payor pays the $9,900, you again have to pay back. If you make a claim on your own policy, your carrier gets a credit for the $15,000 that they paid for your medical bills, and your health carrier gets their $9,900 back, and the consumer is left with $100. It creates a lot of problems in what myself and my cohorts on the defense side, the insurance defense side, have to deal with every day. One of the common problems that you have is the PIP will be exhausted. In other words, your PIP carrier has paid the $15,000. There's no health care coverage to pick up the slack. And you've got a $25,000 policy, and you may have the other $9,900 that hasn't been paid. Well, you've got $25,000 available. You've got to give the money back to your PIP carrier. You've got $9,900 unpaid. You've got to pay that out of the recovery. You once again end up with $100. And that applies if it's your own policy. They get a credit, your health carrier gets the other $99, you end up with $100. It makes it very difficult in that scenario for me as the injured party's attorney and the insurance defense attorney to try and get that case settled, because you got to pay all this money back, and there is $100 left for the person who got hurt. It makes it really, really hard to settle these cases. And I would suggest to you that if we did eliminate that reimbursement, it would make our jobs a lot easier, because we could get these cases resolved. Another thing that I'd like to bring up is that it is my, and I got to tell you, this is anecdotal, I have no statistical data to back this up, but in talking to my brother and sister and on the other side of the fence, they believe, as I believe, that this comes out as a wash. Because literally, you can have a situation where the person that hit you with the same policy as you have, same amounts, insured by the same company. Doesn't matter. You've still got to take it from one pocket of the company, the bad driver's insurance, and you put it back in the same company's pocket on your side, because you have to pay that PIP back. And we think it's wash. The one thing I would finally add, we were very careful when we drafted this bill, because there are other provisions of Oregon law that come into play on this issue. And one of those situations is where you've got the PIP that has been paid, and let's assume $15,000 was paid. And let's assume that, as you are allowed to do, you, on behalf of the injured person, as an attorney, I go in and I make sure the jury knows the total amount of the medical bills. Okay? And let's assume there's no medical coverage, but let's assume the total medical bills are $25,000. When we get a judgment, which includes the medical bills, we made sure that there was not a double recovery by the injured person. What happens in that scenario is, after the jury has said, rendered a verdict, the judge then goes back and says, all right, we know that your insurance company paid $15,000. We know the jury gave you, as a part of their award, the $15,000 that your insurance company paid. The carrier that has to pay for the bad driver gets a credit for the amount that your carrier paid. You don't get to keep the $15,000 that your insurance company already paid. you get your judgment reduced by that 15, and that is in the law to prevent double recovery by injured people. We think that makes perfect sense, and we have left that in place. When the issue came up, we just said, we're not after double recovery. We just want people to get what they pay for, which is their health care coverage and their PIP coverage. And we don't want this to be nothing but a loan by their insurance company that they have to pay back, and they end up not being made whole. So we'd urge your support of this bill. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Jackson from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Yeah, I think I'm... thank you, Mr. Chair. I won't say that. Mr. Jackson?
Yes.
Has this always been the case?
I started practicing in 78, and as long as I've been around, this has been the case.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
And so when an individual is repaying this PIP, what procedure is there? Are you talking about in a premium?
Each of your coverages, PIP will have a separate premium listed.
So when you're paying this back, this is an addition to your current principal or premium?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Vice Chair Nelson, you pay your premium every month or quarterly, however your payment plan is set up, and you see the listing to the right of each coverage of what you're paying. You would continue to pay those premiums throughout this period of time if you wanted to drive an insured vehicle, and the law requires it. But when the money is received from the bad driver's insurance company, at that point, there are a number of ways it goes back to your PIP carrier. One is direct reimbursement from the bad driver's company to your company. Another way is by lien, and there's a separate subrogation statute. So, yes, you continue to pay your premiums throughout this period of time, but when you receive the money that PIP has paid, you have to give it back to them, whatever that amount is.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Galizio.
Mr. Jackson, two questions I'd like you to respond to. One is, what would you say if the claim or the observation was made that this is clearly spelled out in your policy, let the buyer beware? And then secondly, that if we pass this bill, it's going to increase insurance rates.
Well, I would like to hear, Mr. Chairman and Representative Galizio, I don't have the data to speak to the reflection on the increase in premiums. I'm concerned that we're not getting what we pay for now, or what we think we're paying for now. That's of concern to me. Maybe the industry can tell us what the effect would be. I don't know. Understand that as you increase the amount of coverages, you can buy more than $15,000 in PIP for a nominal price. A friend of mine, after I explained this to him, he went out for $22. He increased his coverage from $15,000 to $25,000 for PIP. So you can increase the coverages. My suspicion is I think there will be some increase on the lower end, the minimum coverages. I think the bigger increase is going to be on the people who, like myself and maybe some of you, kick those coverages up because we want to protect ourselves and our family. But I can't specifically answer that question.
Thank you. Representative Girard, another question?
My first question was that this is clearly stated in the literature that you get from the company, so...
Well, it's also clearly allowed under present law. It would be clearly stated that that is no longer the case if the law was changed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Chair Holby. This kind of... you represent the trial lawyers, and one of the problems I would have, a lot of these cases deal with contingency basis, and wouldn't you just be kind of increasing your own paycheck if this passed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, no. And the reason that that is exactly the opposite is one of the methods of recovery that is made by PIP carriers is, I mentioned it, lien. If they elect to recover by lien, they are then asking me, as the attorney for the injured person, to recover that money for them. And I get a fee, a proportionate fee and proportionate costs out of making that recovery for them. If you eliminate the requirement that these payments be returned that's less fees for us. Because we don't, there is no recovery to be made. They can't ask us to make the recovery. We don't make a fee out of that. So in effect, at least with respect to the lien repayment, and that's not the only method, okay? There's direct reimbursement, and we're out of that. So in direct reimbursement, we don't get a fee anyway. If they choose lien reimbursement, we do get a fee, but if we eliminate repayment by virtue of a lien, we don't get a fee out of that because there's no money being paid back. And if it's by subrogation, we're out of that anyway because we don't bring subrogation claims for the insurance company. Their own lawyers do it. And that's the third method, that they can seek reimbursement. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, this decreases our fees, at least in the lien repayment. It cuts it down.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Jackson, for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman.
Next up, I'd like to have John Powell and Steve Merle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Company. With me is Steve Merle, claims attorney with State Farm. Mr. Chairman and members, in just introducing this concept, I think it's important to go back to the coverages on your declaration sheet that were pointed out, the liability insurance, the PIP insurance, and the uninsured motorist insurance. Those coverages are required by law in Oregon. If everyone who drives an automobile is required to have insurance, and those coverages are mandated under Oregon law. The coverages that have been talked about here, the personal injury protection coverage, or known in the acronym as PIP, is one of those coverages. I think there are only about 14 states left that still have PIP coverages. And in 1973, when the legislature mandated these coverages and included PIP, affordability was one of the major issues at hand. How do you keep this coverage affordable? And what is PIP for? PIP is to keep the bill collectors off your porch until a liability issue as to who's at fault is resolved. It is not meant to be another liability coverage. And that is why subrogation has been part of this act since its creation. And unlike in some states, it's worked in Oregon, and people are still able to afford these coverages. But should this bill pass, the one thing that would change on that list of coverages and deck sheet explanation that was given to you is on the premium side, and it would have a significant increase on PIP. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll let Mr. Merle go ahead and talk about the issue in more detail.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Merle. I am employed with State Farm Insurance. I'm an attorney. We've also been kind of asked to speak on the broader insurance interests here today because of time issues to try to keep the committee streamlined. As Mr. Powell mentioned, the PIP law that we're talking about has been a statute since 1973. The terms of that coverage were totally put into the statute as far as what benefits you have to provide, and the subrogation piece, which giving three methods of recovery, was also put in as part of the law. The reason for that was is that in 1973 we had somewhat of a crisis of insurance coverage, court dockets, and legislatures across the nation were looking at, is the tort system worth it anymore? Can we have liability claims? Do we need to go to a no-fault system? As happens in many times when you have a very large crisis like that, compromises arise, and the carrying of what is called an add-on personal injury protection coverage like you have in Oregon was such a compromise. It basically was a no-fault coverage that did exactly what Mr. Powell said, was keep the bill collector off your door so that you had a secure method of getting those bills paid. The concept also was to keep that coverage affordable, that when another party is at fault, will allow the insurance company that has paid PIP benefits to go back and collect that money. That does two important things. One is it keeps insurance rates lower. The other thing is it transfers the responsibility for those damages onto that third party as opposed to you paying them through your own premiums. because that party now has to pay and recover them. We were given three methods. The most common used method, I think, of all the methods, probably 90-95% of all cases today, is direct reimbursement, where insurance companies recover between each other. And if there's a dispute over whether or not the amount is owed, whether it's a reasonable amount, that is settled through private arbitration without the insured or anybody getting involved in it. It's just completely private arbitration, very quickly settling over with. In rare cases, when you're not dealing with a motor vehicle carrier, or you're dealing with a limits case, or you're dealing with some other issues, there are two other methods. One is a lien that Mr. Jackson alluded to, that you could assert a lien. The third method is if the other two methods aren't available to you, it's a catch-all to make sure that you get all of your money. For over 30 years now, the system has worked to keep the bill collector off your door and keep the coverage affordable. That's not been the experience with a lot of other states. Just since the turn of the century, Colorado has done away with PIP. The PIP benefits that they had got to the point where people couldn't afford them. And in general, to be honest with you, with catastrophic cases or cases that have a lot of money involved, auto insurance generally is not a good vehicle for compensation. There are much better vehicles out there. But Colorado's done away with it. My understanding right now is that Florida has a sunset date that they will not be removing out of their law, and PIP will be gone out of Florida also. So we've one of the few PIP states left, and we're one of the really well-functioning ones. Just to a couple of things that Mr. Jackson had alluded to that I'm not in complete agreement with as far as what the bill does and how current coverage functions. In cases where you're looking at recovery right now, this bill would change it. The only time that a person doesn't recover those medical bills is when it's reduced to judgment. That leads me to read the law that as it would be changed by this bill, that not only are you limiting subrogation, but you're also allowing double recovery in all cases that do not go to judgment. And I think that you'll find pretty much agreement among defense and plaintiff bar that probably 98% of all cases settle. So in a settlement, you could force the issue and say, I'm going to get the money back. The way the bill is also drafted, I'm not sure that even when it's reduced to judgment, that allows the company to recover their money. Because the way it is drafted on the first page of the bill is it says that a company that's paid PIP benefits can come into court and make a motion to have that judgment reduced to not include those PIP benefits. It doesn't say that the company gets that money back. So that would be, I think, a total no recovery of PIP. This will substantially impact rates because of that. We've done some look at it. You'll have anywhere from a 40 to 50% impact on rates depending on what level of coverage you buy. And what happens out of this bill. Another area that I want to kind of just state a little bit of disagreement on the record is with uninsured motorist coverage. The way it works, since both of those are first-party coverages, we do not offset what we pay under PIP from the uninsured motorist coverage. That was built into PIP law a long time ago. That's not the case on how that happens. But both of those things are kind of corrective in scope. But I think somewhat to Representative Girard's question, I think this would expand the amount of recoveries out there and the pie that people are receiving because you see double recoveries. Looking at this, it would also, like I mentioned, it would increase the cost. There are several behaviors I'd be worried about that. On one end of the spectrum with high-risk people who are already paying a lot for insurance and the question about whether am I going to continue to participate in the market and those people dropping out of the market and becoming uninsured would bother me a lot. Oregon for a long time has had a very consistent and stable uninsured rate. It's not perfect or ideal, but it's right in the middle of the pack, I think, as far as what the states have. It's about a 12% uninsured rate. The other thing that maybe is even more troubling is that the amount of impact we're talking on in premiums would cause people to change their buying behaviors. It's the kind of thing where, at least based on the State Farm book, I wouldn't think you'd see people dropping out of the market, but you would see people coming in and saying, is there something I can do to make my rates lower? Generally, making rates lower means you're lowering the amounts of coverage you're purchasing, and that's just not a desirable result. With that, I think I'd take any questions that the committee may have.
Representative Galizio, question?
Mr. Merrill, you said 14 states still have PIP?
I think it's 14 now. No, it's 14 now. It's gone down, and so we've been trying to keep track of them as it has been.
And do any of those states have legislation or laws that are similar to what's envisioned in this bill?
I PIP coverage is unique among the states, and so unless you're actually in that state, it's hard to tell what that coverage is. I know for a fact that Florida does not have subrogation in their PIP law, and that's a state that's currently on the process of checking out, and I don't know what the other states have, to be honest with you.
Follow up?
Of the states, I don't know how to answer. Let me think about how I want to ask this, so go on.
While you're thinking, Representative Girard.
Yeah, one thing that got my attention, and it kind of surprises me, and I'm just going to throw some numbers at it, it was the talk that if you had a higher PIP and you got hit by somebody with a lower PIP, that you could only recover the lower PIP value. And I'm trying to understand, like, if say that I had a 25,000 PIP, I got in a really bad car accident, you spent the 25 quickly and gave it to them. But then the individual was found to be the person at fault, but only had a 15,000 PIP. What would happen?
Chair Holby, Representative Girard, I think that that's... Let me kind of explain what would happen, because that's got some... it's not the PIP coverage differences that would make a difference. If you have a $100,000 PIP, which I carry on my car as an artifact of having been an agent, so I probably should have a lower PIP with my risk management tools I have in force, but I have them. Somebody with a $25,000 liability policy hit me and a $15,000 PIP coverage, I would have the full $100,000 of PIP coverage available to me.
Okay.
And that coverage would not only pay for a medical, but in addition to the medical, which is a $100,000 limit, I'd have wage loss. If somebody is not working in the family, they would have loss of services available to them. And if somebody were to die, they have funeral benefits that are available. That PIP coverage includes all those things. Where the limitation runs into is that if I were to be injured so bad, I would lose my entire $100,000, and I'm going to recover from that wrong party, the bad guy. Then there's a question as to whether or not I can get that money, or if that money has to go towards repaying my PIP. The compromise of this current law is it at the point in time that I am able to get all of my out-of-pocket expenses paid for. When I have all my lost wages paid for, when all my medical bills are paid for, that's the point in time at which my carrier can start recovering PIP, but not until.
Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It takes me a while to think.
Does
I know. You already knew that, didn't you? Mr. Merrill, there are 14 states that have PIP, and if you said you're not sure if any of them have currently in law legislation similar to this, would we anticipate that if any states did have a similar in statute law, they would have rates that were 40 to 50% higher?
Chair Holby, Representative Galizio, that's a very difficult question to answer on PIP, because each PIP state is not an identical coverage, and the benefit that it provides, it may be more expansive from one state to another. So I think you've got a set of a bunch of different kinds of fruits instead of apples versus apples to be able to answer that question. Oregon currently, just to kind of give you an idea, overall insurance rates ranks about 28th in the nation. So most of the states, you take 51, including the District of Columbia, we're going to have about the same or a little bit higher rates that we pay, and then the rest of that are below the 28 are going to have higher than we do. And we're right in the middle of the pack, and part of that reason is we mandate a lot of coverage. We say you have to have the liability coverage, you have to have the PIP coverage, and you have to have the uninsured motorist coverage. And I think that takes a contrast where you take a homeowner's line of insurance, I think we're like 49th in cost. And it's that difference in how much coverage you say a person has to carry that makes that difference.
Follow-up?
So since the fruits are so different in the different states, we would need to take your word for it that if this bill were to pass, the rates would go up 50%.
Chair Holby, Representative Gleasel, that's actually, we did the analysis with our own numbers. We looked at it and said, if this happens, this is how many dollars we can lose. And we had to take my word for it, but it is done on a mathematical calculation. It's not just an estimation. We've looked at our typical PIP premium. It would go up 50%.
So could the committee have that analysis we can make a more informed decision, even though we're kind of slow?
Yeah. Probably, Chair Glee, I can give you those numbers. Those numbers were given to me. I don't have how they figured it out, but I can give the end product.
Sorry, we could just have the end product. We couldn't get the actual...
I'll give you what I have, which is the end product.
Yeah, and I'll follow up on that. And maybe a written statement to go along with those numbers would be helpful to all the committee, I think. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so that I'm sure I understand what you've said, I want to give you a scenario, and you tell me if I'm right.
Okay.
If I have $100,000 of PIP, and the other motorist who is at fault has $25,000 of liability, and I have $110,000 in medical loss of employment, those kinds of losses that are covered by PIP. That's all paid for, and the PIP carrier gets $15,000 of that back from the other insurance. Is that correct?
Chair Holy, Representative Wright, that's not quite correct. It's very close, but it's not quite there.
Okay.
We would pay all of your medical expenses, and I'm assuming the example you're talking about, you had $110,000 that was paid for all out of PIP, and that's between lost wages and medical bills or whatever that PIP provides for. And then there's a $25,000 of liability coverage. We can recover that in $25,000 liability coverage provided that our PIP payments have paid for all your out-of-pocket expenses. And I say that because the PIP coverage only lasts for a year, and after the year was over, you may have had more expenses that carried on that were out-of-pocket. And if you get to the point where us recovering our money is not going to allow you to have your out-of-pocket expenses paid for, we can't get to it. You get to be paid for your expenses before we get to the liability coverage. I can see that maybe didn't quite do it.
I didn't see how that was different than what I said, but
you didn't use plain talk.
I did, actually. He didn't.
Oh, no.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. So I get my full 110 paid somehow. And there's $25,000 in liability that the other motorist has, and that would come to us, to you and I, right? And since you paid $10,000 more than what my coverage was on PIP, but I get everything paid, PIP would get that $15,000 of that back. Is that not? I don't.
Shareholder Representative Riley, from the way I understand your hypothetical, we can get the full $25,000 to pay back and reimburse us for the PIP we've paid, because we've paid out $110,000.
Okay. Same thing. Okay.
Other questions? Looks like you're done. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Drive safely.
Always.
And follow the law.
Larry.
Next up, I'd like Greg Ledbetter.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Greg Ledbetter, and in order to reassure my colleagues from the industry behind me, I work for the insurance division, but I'm not here on their behalf. I'm here representing SEIU 503. I have over 25 years of experience in the property and casualty industry, so I can answer some of your technical questions if you have any. I'm here in support of the bill on the basis that, very simply put, what this thing attempts to do is get the injured party fully paid back for all of their damages before the insurance company has reimbursed their money. As I understand the bill, it still allows for reimbursement to the insurance company in probably 90% of the accidents that occur, because they're usually minor, with $1,000 or $2,000 worth of medical bills. And that money would not be affected by this bill at all, as I understand the way it's written. I think that's a pretty basic concept, I think, in terms of consumer protection, is that the injured party who's been paying for this insurance should be fully compensated for their damages before they have to pay the insurance companies back. And I think this bill gets pretty close to getting there. It may need some work in terms of accomplishing it completely, and I'd be willing to help if that was asked. I would like also to respond to Representative Galizio's questions about the buyer beware. I'm sure you've all read the statute, or the statutes that this bill would repeal. The language in those statutes is pretty much duplicated in your insurance policy. And if you can understand it, I give you a lot of credit, because it's a very difficult thing to, for me to explain to anyone. And I think because of that, with people, even getting to them to read the declarations page is difficult. And when they do, as Neil Jackson pointed out, this is what it appears to say. And you, and the advice that I give people constantly is read the declarations page. That's telling you what you're buy, what you're paying for. And if it's not on there, you're not getting it. And it can be very, very confusing for people that get involved in the situations that this arises. The other piece of it is, in my entire time in the business, I always thought that this subrogation was the dog chasing its tail. Now, I don't have the actuarial figures for it, but as Mr. Jackson was saying, you know, you're paying it out here and you're getting it back here, and I think it's a zero-sum game industry-wide, and there may be, because obviously if there's only one insurance company involved, and there's a lot of accidents out there where that's the case, you're just taking the money out of one pocket and putting in the other. And for the industry as a whole, and I, you know, this is intuitive based on a lot of experience, but it seems to me that that part of it is just going to be a wash, that you pretty well are going to recover the same as what you pay back, with the exception of the companies that do a better job of picking the people that aren't going to have accidents. So there may be some offset there. I also think the industry would save quite a lot of money on administrative costs. The all of this effort to get their money back is not cheap. The arbitration process that Mr. Merle mentioned is not cheap, and those costs would also be eliminated. And then you, combining that with the fact that a very small percentage of cases actually reach these high limits, I just think that the cost of off the top of your head, in a quick look at it, as I think State Farm did, would lead you to believe a 50% increase in PIP. But I think a closer look at it might give you a different number. And you may want to consider getting some information from the DCBS. They have actuaries on staff there that could take a close look at this, too, and see what they come up with for you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused because I hear two different things from different people. Let me give you a scenario. If I have, you know, $50,000 of PIP, and the person who hits me, and it's their fault, has $25,000 in liability, and I have $20,000 in cost, medical costs, that are paid for out of my PIP. Okay? And now you're saying that the insurance company gets the liability from the other company to cover that. Somebody paid for my medical. Who was it?
Your own insurance company under the PIP. So if you get in an accident and you get injured, you turn all your medical bills into your own car insurance company, mm-hmm. and they pay them. Mm-hmm. Then you go to the other guy's insurance company to settle your injury claim.
Why would I go to? I've already been paid for my injury. Why would I go to recover it again?
For your non-economic general damages, pain and suffering.
Okay.
And the scenarios that you're mentioning, there's never any money left over for the pain and suffering part of it.
Okay.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Mr. Ledbetter. Can you just define the word subrogation? It's not so much for me, but I think Representative Gerard might have been confused.
I prefer the term reimbursement. Technically, what it means is that an insurer can collect back from a third party, whether it's an insurance company or not, who has caused my insurance to pay the money out. It's hard to get through this without a lot of insurance jargon, but... It just means that if your health insurance or your PIP insurance or when you have a collision claim that somebody else caused damage to your car, it means that the company that pays for it can be reimbursed from the at-fault third party.
Thank you. More questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ledbetter, I'm not convinced that this is a good bill yet. So would it be possible that you could put some scenarios down in writing and show how this works out to the advantage of all concerned for us, please?
Certainly.
Thank you.
Representative Riley Galuzio, did you have a question?
I don't.
You don't, okay. Neither
do I.
And you don't either. Good. Thank you for your testimony today. I appreciate
one more
it.
Question.
Thank you.
No, this is the last call.
Okay. Well,
unless you're going to ask me after. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, as long as you're here, what is the position of the insurance division?
Well, I can't really speak for them. I believe it's neutral.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next up, thanks a lot for your testimony. I appreciate you coming in and trying to shed some light on a complicated subject matter. Anybody else want to testify on House Bill 3081? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3081 and open a hearing on House Bill 3086. Steve, why don't you give us a little preview of the bill?
Thank you, Chair Holby. House Bill 3086 revises motor vehicle liability insurance, and in particular, I think it deals with the family exclusion issue that some of the members of the committee may have heard about.
Thank you. First up, we'll have Neil Jackson and Ada Valenti.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Neil Jackson. I would ask that there's another person on the list, Tasha Brennan, be called up with me.
Certainly. She most definitely can come up.
Who is that?
Tasha Mowry.
Mowry, I'm sorry, my mistake.
If you'd state your name again for the record, please, and start off with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a member of the Board of Governors, and I'm here in support of House Bill 3086. There are actually two provisions in this bill that affect Oregon law. The first provision is the family member step-down or family member exclusion. Let's go back to our coverages that we talked about earlier on House Bill 3081 and translate it into what these provisions do. Really, for purposes of this bill, you have to look at greater coverage than the 2550 minimum we were talking about earlier. And the reason for that is this bill doesn't affect the injured parties involved unless you're talking about greater coverage than those minimums. Here's how it works. Instead of the 2550 coverage we had, this time you want to have additional protection for your family, both financially and for your loved ones, and so you buy $100,000 coverage. And what that coverage equates to is $100,000 per person up to $300,000 per accident. Necessarily, you're paying a higher premium because you have greater coverage. And what the scenario that we're trying to deal with in this case is, let's say that you're driving your car and you've got two of your children in the car and you've got two neighbor children and you're taking them to a soccer game or a baseball game or whatever. Now, you've got your $100,000 liability coverage in place here, and you've got, and for these purposes, let's just stay with the $15,000 PIP.
Let's say you lose control of your car for some reason, you're not paying attention, and you crash it into a tree, and you severely injure your two children and the neighbor's two children. You know what your policy is. You think you got $100,000 coverage, and because the accident is your fault, you go, well, it's going to be okay. These four kids were hurt badly, and we've got some big medical bills, but I've got a total of $300,000 to take care of this. No, you don't. The reason that you don't is all policies in Oregon are allowed to limit the coverage to your family members to $25,000 maximum for liability recovery. So in that scenario, what you have is a situation where even if your children were more severely injured than the neighbor kids, your children's recovery will be limited. They'll get their PIP paid for, okay? But then when they go, if their bills are $50,000, if they're $75,000, whatever they are, they're going to get the $15,000 on the PIP, and they're going to be able to recover an additional $25,000 out of the liability, and that's it. And the reason they're limited to that is because they are a blood relative or member of your household, adopted child, living in the same household as you. Their recovery is limited to $25,000 per person. Let's take another scenario, and it plays out the same way. You're driving with your wife, one of your kids, you're taking a vacation, and you happen to decide to drive through Corvallis, and you see a very nice-looking college student who's saying, I'm heading to California. And you say, hey, let's give him a ride. And everybody, yeah, that'd be fun, somebody to talk to. So you pick up this college student hitchhiker, and you head down the road. Again, you lose control of your car. Your wife is limited to $25,000. Your kid is limited to $25,000. The person you don't even know can make a $100,000 recovery. This is really, we believe this is an anachronism. Back in the days when it was much more difficult to diagnose injuries, I mean, now we've got CAT scans, we've got MRIs, we've got CTs. Medical science has come a long way. Originally, one of the justifications for the family exclusion was that there was a fear that spouses and their kids would make dummy claims, phony claims. I submit to you that that is no longer valid with the state of medical science, because if there is something wrong with you, first off, if you're making a claim, you have to prove that. If you're saying you were severely injured, you've got to prove that. And the state of medical science now, I think, just severely limits the ability to submit and prevail on phony claims. The other reason that I'm aware of originally when this exclusion was in place was that there was concern voiced that this would create dissension in the family. And I certainly don't think that's valid, because in the scenarios that I've posited to you, would you not want your spouse and your kids to have available the same amount of funds to compensate them both for their bills and for the pain they went through as you would your neighbor's kids, as you would the college student that you picked up? I think you would. And I submit that those are the two rationales that I'm aware of that have been always advanced when we suggested that this family exclusion be eliminated. This is also left over from something that this legislature eliminated years and years ago, which was called the guest passenger statute. That was a statute that said that if you were giving someone a ride, that you would not be responsible if you drove bad and hurt them, unless they had paid you something to be driving them wherever you were driving them to. And this legislature eliminated that a long time ago. I believe the family exclusion should have been eliminated at the same time. Let me go to the next section of the bill. That is the government vehicle exclusion for underinsured motorist claims. This section of the bill deals with the situation, and it's a very unfortunate situation because it just actually arose in 1998 as a result of an appellate court decision in Oregon. And as a matter of fact, I will tell the committee, Madam Vice Chair and committee members, that the two people affected by that court decision are going to testify today. But explaining as simply as I can, the government vehicle exclusion is, if you get in an accident, first let's set up our coverages. You've got a 100-300 policy, and you decide you want more protection than that. And so you buy what's called an umbrella policy, because you want $1 million coverage to protect yourself and your family members. So you think, great, whatever happens to somebody in my family, whatever happens, it's going to be covered. And I want to leave out the family exclusion. that's a different issue. But you think whatever happens, we're covered. Let's just say it's you. Forget the family. It's just you. I got $1 million coverage. If the person that I have an accident with, if they have no coverage, I can make a claim for up to $1 million if I'm severely injured. If they have no insurance, I can make a UM claim for $1 million. If they have some, but not as much as me, I can make a UIM claim against my own policy for the difference between what they've got and $1 million. That is true in every situation except where you are in an accident with a governmental vehicle and it's the government driver's fault. They crash into you. The decision that I told you about earlier is a decision that said you don't get to make a claim on your own umbrella policy for up to $1 million, no matter how badly you're hurt, because the way our law is written now, it says that you are only allowed to recover the maximum amount that you are able to under the law. That's the wording of the court. And since the government, our state government, all governmental entities, have a limit on the amount that you can recover from them for the negligent torts of their employees, that means legally that's all you can recover under the law. Therefore, you can't make a claim against your own policy for the excess. And it doesn't matter how big your bills are. You can have $600,000 in bills. The maximum amount you will recover under present law, if it's a state vehicle, is $200,000. That's it. You don't get to go to your own policy for the other $400,000 in bills that are outstanding. So if you don't have a good health care plan, you're going on Oregon Health Plan to pay the rest of those bills. And it's results from a court decision, and we think what happened was, as the statutes are being modified and rewritten over the years, nobody foresaw that this scenario would occur, and it can have some very devastating results, as you will see. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. We'll hear from Ms. Valenti and Ms. Is it Mowry? Mm-hmm. And then we'll take questions. Thank you.
Yeah, my name is Ada Valenti, and on March 24th, 2004, we were in a very bad accident. My son was severely injured. I got my leg broken in three different places. My grandson was severely injured. And it took surgery for all of us to... my son had surgery, my grandson had surgery, and I had surgery on my leg. And there was a child in the car that was a friend of my son's, and he was killed. Now, I was under the impression that I had $300,000 liability. And I didn't know about this $25,000... whatever you call it. And it wasn't until a year after that I found out about that. And I thought I was completely covered to take care of everything, but that was not the case. That was not the case. They told me that I was getting $25,000. And the child that was killed got $100,000. My son had to go and get himself a lawyer to get him to pay his bills, which was over $75,000. Mine's were $30,000, and my grandson's was $28,000. So this thing about the $25,000 is ludicrous in my books, because if I'm paying for $300,000 a liability, that's what I want to get at the end of the day, which I didn't get. So that's why I'm here today, to let you people know that it's time to make a change there. And that's about all I have to say.
Thank you very much. Now, Ms. Mowry.
Hi, I'm Tasha Mowry, and I'm from Fairview, Oregon, and I'm here to talk about the family exclusion law to tell you my story. Back in October 2nd of 2005, my boyfriend and I were driving from Portland to Bend, where we are currently living, and my boyfriend lost control of his vehicle and slammed into another vehicle, severely injuring me and the other driver. And my injuries were, I had a closed head injury, 5 broken bones in my foot, a broken clavicle. I had to be life flighted to St. Charles Medical Center. And the worst of it was that I was 26 weeks pregnant, and I lost her after 2 days, well, like a day and a half actually. And I don't remember anything from after the accident happened for about 7 to 10 days, but I found out about 2 weeks after my accident, they were already trying to get me to settle for $25,000. And when I'd first moved to Bend and switched my insurance companies, I'd called around, and when I called Farmers, they told me for $12 more a month, I could have the $100,000 policy. So, of course, that's what I got. And then after my accident, they told me that I could only get the $25,000. And my medical bills are about $45,000 just for my hospital stay, not to mention all the follow-up surgeries and care I've needed since then, which I have to pay back because I was covered by the Oregon Health Plan. But if I get any settlement, I have to pay it all back. And they want to only give me $25,000 for me and $25,000 for my daughter, and is because my boyfriend was driving. And I just think that that law needs to be changed.
Thank you very much. Committee members, questions for the panel? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much, and I'm very sorry, Ms. Mallory and Ms. Valenti, for what you had to go through. I just want to ask, Ms. Mallory, did your boyfriend, was it his car?
And it was my car. Okay. And I should say that the other driver, which he deserved it, he got the $100,000.
So, follow up, please. So, you were carrying the insurance on your car at that time that he was driving.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you. And then I'm just curious, Ms. Valenti, was your carrier Farmers Insurance also?
No, I didn't have Farmers Insurance. It was MetLife. And it was a rental car we were, and it was rented, we rented it from Enterprise.
And just one last follow-up.
Yes,
please. And questions for both of you. When you took out these insurance policies, did your agent have to prepare a document that clearly showed...
It's on your policy, yes.
Prepared
yes.
That clearly showed each amount of premium mm-hmm. plus mm-hmm. how much coverage you would get in case of a certain type of incident accident?
Mm.
Did you have a document like that? Would that have helped if you didn't?
Well, if you're asking me, did I know that doesn't state on your policy that it comes it boils down to that house $25,000 household thing? I never seen that in my policy. All I was under the impression was that I had a liability of $300,000, and it would be sufficient to pay everything that. At the time when the thing was going on, I believed it was sufficient to pay out all that was necessary.
Last follow-up, please, Madam Chair. Well, I guess what I'm trying to get to is our good Representative Riley had a bill that passed the House today regarding plain talk
mm-hmm.
and how important it is that, you know, those of us who can't understand insurance ease or government ease mm-hmm. can really mm-hmm. see it in some terms that maybe 10-year-olds can understand. So I'm just curious that was there any document prepared for you, either of you, beyond the policy that's completely specified your coverage and what it covered and in what case?
Can I just ask you for this mic?
No.
And,
no.
Okay, thank
you. Same remains.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have is for Mr. Jackson, and it has to do with page 5 of this bill. And it's under my, from your testimony and some of the language on lines 16 through 18, it isn't just the medical bills that would be subject to the additional amount of money, but pain and suffering would be as well. Is that your understanding of that? So that you could ask for a pain and suffering clause?
That is correct, because part of the intent of the bill is to allow the injured person to be made whole. Yeah.
Okay. Just this is a comment. You kind of got me on the medical expenses part, but the pain and suffering, I have a real problem with. But that might just be me.
Committee members, we are going to be running up against some time issues, so are there any other questions for this panel before we move on? We have other witnesses on this bill, and then we have at least one more bill we want to get to today. Okay, thank you very much. Next, the 16, John Powell and Steve Morrell, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and I will just let Mr. Murrell go straight into his testimony in deference to your time crunch. We understand.
Thank you, Mr. Powell.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Steve Murrell. I'm an attorney employed by the State Farm Insurance Companies, here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3086. As we're going forward, I think today's set of bills does one thing, is it each one of these bills you're talking about will have an effect on the cost of insurance, and that effect will be independent but cumulative. I think it's important for us to think of as we're going through this. I think it's important also to understand how we got to where we are with this family member, what I call a family member step down. What it does is it steps the limits down to the financial responsibility limits that the state says you have to carry to cover anybody that's in your car. Prior to 1984, in Oregon, there was interfamily immunity. Basically, that kids can't make claims against parents, spouses can't make claims against each other. That's just a way of promoting family harmony. The courts in Oregon, I suspect, as some of you are right now having trouble, or struggled with that and said, okay, is that appropriate? And I think in a very extreme case called Wynn versus Gilroy, the court said, okay, parents can now make claims against children can make claims against their parents. You know, provided that it's a claim out of something out of the normal of the parent-child relationship. In that case, they decided that somebody driving drunk was outside the normal parent-child relationship. At that time, and up until 1991, in harmony with the law, the industry had an absolute exclusion for injury to any family member. And I think that's important. This is not something evil that the insurance industry generated. We were following where the state law was. Shortly after that, another case came to rise, which was called Collins versus Farmers, and in that case the court said, yeah, that type of exclusion is still valid, even though we've gotten rid of family member immunity, but we have a financial responsibility law that says you have to provide at least $25,000 per person, $50,000 total, and so we will read your policy to step down like that. The industry, taking that cue, stepped down their exclusions, and now in bold print, all caps, in your policies, you'll find an exclusion that steps it down to that amount of money. Some companies will do it in the body of the policy. Others will do it on the declarations page. In catastrophic injury cases, I don't know if there's ever going to be enough money for you. And I think that's important to keep in mind, is that there are other risk management tools. We could choose not to have that exclusion or policy. We have not gone to, because a fault-based coverage and setting up that kind of contest between the family members, we don't feel like is a right way to do things. If you wanted to do things, I think there's other rational ways that you could take a look at compensation that pays for medical bills and those sorts of things that doesn't set up that fault-based type of dispute. I think that, you know, one of the things you can do is there's a lot of discussion about health insurance, making sure everybody is able to have that and afford that. I think that's really where this discussion goes to. The second part of the bill that I just want to talk to you briefly, and I'll take your questions because we are under a time crunch, is not an insurance problem at all. What we're talking about in that part of the bill is basically transferring government liability onto underinsured motorist coverage. Right now, since the state had a constitution, the constitution of the state made the state immune from tort liability, no remedy. At about the same time, uninsured motorist coverage was being mandated by this legislature, sometime late 60s, early 70s, the state had a limited waiver of liability, and we mandated uninsured motorist coverage at the same time. Uninsured motorist coverage has never covered government cars, with the idea being that either the government's responsible and the state says the government can go ahead and pay for it, or the state says the government isn't responsible and nobody owes that bill. This issue that's been kind of incorporated into an auto insurance bill is really the issue of government liability that you hear discussed about OHSU and those types of things, and that's where that debate belongs. It doesn't belong in an insurance policy. If it's a good idea, whether you were to put it in an insurance policy or whether you were to change the policy with the Tort Claim Act on what the limits are or going into it pay for it. My suggestion is if you were going to do it right and put it in the tort cap, because part of the tort system is molding people's behavior, making sure they're doing things right, and that's really where that belongs, is with the government people who are driving cars and not what you need to protect yourself against them when they have the accident that's their fault. So with that, I'll take any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Mr. Morrell. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a bit more problem with this one than the last one. And there are a couple of reasons. I guess what I'd like you to tell me is what can I do to protect people if the insurance I buy doesn't do it?
Chair Bonamici, Representative Riley, what I'd recommend you do is in this scenario, in both of these, the government car scenario and the liabilities have higher PIP limits. Have higher PIP limits, because that's a no-fault coverage. It doesn't matter whose fault it is, and that takes care of those bills.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't catch what has more coverage.
Chair Bonamici, Representative Nelson, the PIP coverage that we discussed before, the medical pain coverage, if you wanted to protect yourself in these two scenarios presented in this bill, that's what I'd recommend, is you get more of that coverage on your policy.
Follow up.
Yes,
this greatly bothers me about government.
And I'll take the opportunity to ask a quick question just to make sure I understand this. So the family exclusion doctrine does not apply to PIP coverage?
Correct.
Thank you.
I'm sure if I finish.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you
That's okay. No, it really does bother me. I wonder if you'd be so kind to give me a draft of what I could do to make that change.
Chair Colby, Representative Nelson, in Oregon, the Oregon Constitution said the government bodies are not responsible for a tort, period. There was no remedy if they did a wrong. Sometime along the way, I think in the 70s, the Oregon legislature, which the Constitution allowed them to do that, has a limited waiver where you can collect $100,000 as an individual against a state agency that causes you harm. And then I think more recently they've modified that if your medical bills are such that it exceeds that $100,000, there's up to another $100,000 available. That was to protect the state from having to pay claims. Whether that's fair or not to an individual, I guess, is your all choices as policymakers. The state has as much money as they want to tax and raise to pay claims. And that's really where I think that belongs, and that's the decision you're making. Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
Mr. Chairman, may I answer Representative Hovley's, I'm sorry, Representative Riley's thoughts?
Certainly, I don't know what thoughts they were, but go ahead.
I think he got a kick out of Mr. Merle's statement that the state has the ability to tax and pay claims, and I would put that in this context. I think the state indeed does have the ability to pay these claims much more than a single mother struggling to get by on a minimum wage job, trying to pay her insurance bills and having this cost shifted onto them.
Absolutely.
So there is two ways to look at that issue.
There are three, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Certainly, go ahead.
The third way is that the insurance can pay it. And, you know, you're trying to pit the state against this mother is atrocious. And my answer to that is that there is a third way, and the insurance could pay it.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, the point is if the person's insurance has to pay it, the person buying insurance has to pay the premium. And
no question.
And they were not necessarily at fault. It was the party that put the other car on the road.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thanks for your testimony. I appreciate it. And thank you, Representative Bonamici, for tending to the gavel while I was gone.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Next up, Pat. Or Patty, I'm not sure which. Pat Surfair? Surfay?
Surface.
Surface. Sorry. And James Surface. And we need, and I'm going to have to, you know, keep your testimony very, very brief if possible. We got some other business yet to attend to, so if you can just spend a couple minutes apiece, that would be appreciated. If you can just summarize your testimony, if you have written testimony, certainly you can hand it in.
Okay. My name's Pat Surface, and I don't know, they just told me to come. I was in a car accident, and the car was, like, totaled, and I was totaled, and the kids were totaled, and I was in the hospital in a coma, but I don't know, I don't remember a lot. Well, I don't remember any of that, but, and I don't remember a lot of things before and after, and I just, you know, it's really sad for the kids. And well, I was just thinking that if we pay for the insurance, we should have got the money. That's it.
Thank you.
My name is James Surface, and I'm a physical therapist. And we did pay our premiums. And what the second part of this House bill is about the governmental immunity, and I wish to address that. But before I actually would like to go with my own personal feelings on that, I'd like to disagree with the attorney from State Farm. And the respect is that we did have coverage. I had $1 million coverage on my vehicle. And because of the governmental immunity, we were only allowed to basically get $100,000. It was documented that my wife's head injury, head trauma, was $1 million compensable claim. Because of the governmental immunity and because of American Spirit Insurance Company, as by the state of Oregon's law, we were only entitled to recover $100,000. So that is why I would like to disagree. Now to my statement. I purchased a, being a physical therapist, as I'm sure the vast majority of the committee members here, you folks do not have a $25, a $50, a $100, or a $250,000 limit. I would say that the majority of the committee member and the majority of people in this room have a $1 or $2 million umbrella policy. With that umbrella policy, you are absolutely, positively assured that if you are involved in a car accident, you have $1 million to $2 million worth of policy. That also includes the underinsurance policy. We all paid our premium for that umbrella policy. We paid that premium with the understanding that if we were involved in a car accident, regardless if it was our fault or their fault, who hit us, who we hit, we would be able to compensate the people if it was our fault, or in turn, if someone hit us, we would be compensated. And I agree, you cannot put a limit. There is no amount of money when a person has a head trauma or a member of that car has lost their life, and you're absolutely right. And the money is not the issue here. The issue is paying what we paid for as consumers in the state of Oregon. There was a case, and also for the attorney from State Farm, it was not the early 70s when the legislature put this in. I believe it was 1968 when the law was put into our current state law. We went ahead and went through the appellate decision for the state of Oregon. We started with the Superior Court and went to the appellate court and eventually ended up with the Supreme Court, and that was a Surface versus the American Spirit Insurance Company. During that time, one of the justices, which in turn it took 5 years to go ahead for the Supreme Court to rule on this case. At that time, as part of our as part of the arguments, one of the Supreme Court justices, and I do not remember who it was, asked the attorney for American Spirit Insurance Company if the Surfaces were involved with a vehicle other than an e-license plate. There's also been testimony saying it's a state vehicle. I want to sit here and say, folks, it is not a state vehicle. It is any e-license plate. It is a water vehicle. It is a road vehicle. It is any e-license plate. It is not only the state of Oregon. So anytime you see an e-license plate, be aware, if they hit you and kill you, you get $100,000. One of the questions that the Supreme Court justice asked at that time to the attorney was, sir, if the surfaces were involved with another vehicle that was not a public entity, would your insurance company pay? After some hem and hawing by the attorney, to the best of my knowledge, said, yes, we would. They basically interpreted state law, the Supreme Court of the state of Oregon eventually found in the favor of the insurance companies from the respect of the $100,000 immunity. As part of that policy, as part of that ruling from the Supreme Court, they said that it was up to the legislature to change the law. Therefore, what I would hope, each of you would have this opportunity to change a very bad law. Another point. I was not aware there was nothing in my policy there was nothing on the declaration of my umbrella policy that stated, oh, by the way, if you get hit by an e-license plate in the state of Oregon, you're only responsible for $100,000 non-economic and medical. You might want to go ahead and take a look at the medical plus the non-economic for the first part of this bill, because the way that the state law reads is that they pay medical and suffering, and I think what that's the first part of this bill tried to address to bring it into uniformity. When I visit with any of my patients or any non-professional or professional people, they are absolutely positively shocked, realizing that the policy that we paid for, i.e. the $1 million, we had no right in this world to collect that under current state law. Finally, I appreciate the time and bearing with me. The last thing that I would like to say is, on your way home tonight, an e-license plate, hopefully not, if God willing, hits you. And therefore, you needed your hands to make a living. You needed your head to make a living. You needed your arms to make a living. That e-license plate has taken away your livelihood and has taken away your umbrella policy. They will not pay according to Oregon law. So that basically what happens, that e-license plate has a get-out-of-jail card free. That means if that person is having a bad day and they take the water truck with an e-license plate, or let's say a person steals the e-license plate and they hit you on your way home, or worse yet, you have your child or your spouse in that car and that stolen e-license plate hits you and takes away your hands or takes away your wife or your husband's ability, sorry folks, you're at $100,000. You folks now have the great opportunity to change this law, and it is not going to cost the state a cent, because you paid for your umbrella policy. You paid for something that if you were injured, you should have the right to collect. Thank you for this opportunity. It's helped got rid of some baggage.
Thank you very much for coming forward and sharing your testimony with us. Really important. Appreciate it. I'm going to move on to the next witness, seeing our time. So next up, real quick, Greg Ledbetter.
Thank you, Chairman and members of the committee. Again, my name is Greg Ledbetter. I'm here on behalf of Service Employees International Union 503. I am an employee of the insurance division. I am not here representing them. I'm on my own time. We support this bill. I think you've seen some of the reasons why. I think that the testimony from these people that have been victimized by these particular situations, it's important for you to recognize that those same situations carry over to the previous bill that I testified on. The most severely injured people are the ones that are most damaged by the current situation and the way insurance policies are written. I think it's important to recognize that what insurance really is, it's a way that we all pool our money in order to help those that have an unexpected catastrophic loss. Insurance companies believe in that definition, and they really hate getting nickel and dime to death on the small claims. And yet, when the big claims come along, they get out of them. And one of the ways they've gotten them out of them is on this family immunity doctrine and on this government immunity doctrine. There's no way to protect yourself by an uninsured motorist claim against the state, as Mr. Service just indicated. He had $1 million in UM coverage. If it's an e-car that hits you, you don't have that kind of coverage anymore. And since those cases are so rare and so infrequent, I just don't see that there's going to be any significant increase in the premium that we all have to pay. They're rare, but the people that are damaged by it are incredibly damaged by it. I think that the issue on the step-down limits is another difficult one to really get your hands around. And the question from Representative Galizio, I believe, about whether or not it was on, oh no, it was Representative Nelson, about whether you can read your declarations page and see this step down. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. The history on that does go back to the family immunity doctrine, and insurance policies originally excluded it completely in conjunction with the law. Then they tried to once that law was repealed, they kept it in the policy. We're told they couldn't do that to the extent of the financial responsibility law. So they changed that language. And that was buried in small print that said, we will not cover injury to family members to the extent of the financial responsibility law, but it didn't spell out the numbers. Again, the Oregon Supreme Court had to step in and tell insurers, look, you got to make this clear. So now they put the numbers inside of the policy, but they still have the step-down limits, and they're still inside of the policy that nobody reads. At least let's require them to put those step down limits on the declarations page. And if an individual or family wants to buy more than that, and I'll bet you in this competitive environment that we have in this state, it ain't going to be that much more, that you can buy it back. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and giving us your point of view on this. Appreciate it. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3086. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3075. Steve, would you give us a brief description?
Thank you, Chair Hovey. House Bill 3075 permits a person to bring action against an insurer or other person that commits or performs an unfair claim settlement practice.
Thank you. First up, I'd like Neil Jackson. And I am going to be kind of strict on this. I'm going to limit you to 2 minutes.
Talk fast.
State your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a member of the Board of Governors here to speak in favor of House Bill 3075, which is a bill which does nothing more than allow the citizens of this state to enforce a law that has been affecting this state for decades. It's called the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. It specifies specific actions by insurance companies that are against the law, and that if they do them, they are a violation of the law. The unfortunate thing is that it is not privately enforceable. Oregon case law, our appellate courts have said that private citizens cannot bring an action if they are subject to a violation of this law. This bill would make it privately enforceable. It sets damages at either the amount of damages the person suffers as a result of the violation or $200, whichever is greater, and a court or jury can award punitive damages if they find it's appropriate, and it provides for prevailing party attorney's fees. The reason that we at OTLA think this is an important bill is it's only enforceable now through DCBS, and they don't have the resources. If you've got a $500 or $1,000 dispute between a consumer and an insurer, DCBS does not have the resources to go after that company to privately enforce that. These practices that we're talking about steering, where insurance adjusters will try and get the person whose car's got to be fixed to go to one of their favorite shops, which is against the law that we have now, but it happens on a daily basis. We're talking about where insurance companies are refusing to respond to claims. There's a specific section that says they have to do that, and they don't do it. We're talking about situations where once they know how much it's going to cost to fix a car, then they find out that the person whose car is damaged and needs to be fixed is going to make a claim for the decreased value of the car after the repair. They hold hold that second claim hostage. We're not going to fix your car unless you give up this claim. I'm here to tell the committee this goes on every day. DCBS cannot enforce this statute, and there are other violations of the law. Senator Monroe, when he heard about steering, made the statement, these folks are breaking the law. And we all went, yeah.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair.
Next up, I'd like John Powell, Ken Cooley, and Steve Morrell. Gentlemen, if you can state your name and be brief, I would appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, just an inquiry. Mr. Cooley does have about a 10-minute slide presentation on what the bill does and how and its effects. If the committee would have time.
Yeah, we don't have time today, but we'd certainly take that in paper form if you can give us the PowerPoint or whatever it is in paper form.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Cooley can abbreviate his presentation and just give it to you verbally in an abbreviated form. Mr. Cooley is from Sacramento, California, State Farm Insurance Companies. He's also a city councilor in Rancho Cordova, where he is elected at large with about 60,000 constituents, just about like a House member here.
Thank you. And I apologize, Mr. Cooley.
No, I understand.
Running out of time, but if you could give us a kind of a summary of it, it would be great.
You bet. It is my pleasure to be here again. Ken Cooley with State Farm Insurance. I'm state counsel in Sacramento, California. I am an elected official. And of note, my city is about 60,000. It's actually was identified as the most rapidly diversifying community in California during the 90s. And about half of my residents are low and moderate income constituents, live in low and moderate income census tracts. And I think the big picture on this issue, you know, John Kennedy, when he was president, said to govern is to choose. And I think you sit in a state where you are 49th in terms of premium, in terms of homeowners premiums among the 51 jurisdictions, 28th in auto premiums. You have a pretty healthy environment. And the issue on all of these matters, including this one, is what are we getting if we pass this law? Basically, 3075 would institute in California, or here in the state of Oregon, a doctrine which has been dysfunctional in jurisdictions where it tried, West Virginia, in the state of California, and has led to increased fraud, increased rates, tremendous burden on the courts. Mr. Powell is circulating a handout, or will circulate a handout, which includes some charts that are really based not on insurance data. For example, one study is from West Virginia. This was conducted at the request of the West Virginia legislature. It was completed in 2005. And it points out that the evidence are that West Virginia's approach to third-party causes is in the minority. It has bad effects on the insurance climate, an insurance climate overly litigious, premium rates that are higher because of it. In the state of California, a study conducted in 2003 by our court system determined that during the period of time that this doctrine was in place in California, claims in the state court system, filed suits on the auto side, jumped 63%. There is this second lawsuit doctrine. Fundamentally, what this is about is for every liability claim, for every insurance claim, there is an ability, if you are not happy with how you've been treated, there is the ability to file a second lawsuit direct against the insurer, bypassing the policy limits. For single violations of the Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. So it is a dynamic that generates more underlying claims because there's more opportunity for the second lawsuits. This has been seen in California, and our court system was sort of staggered under that burden. I should add that late in this period, I was actually the Assembly's Chief Committee Counsel on Banks and Insurance in California. Actually, I worked for Willie Brown when his chief of staff was a guy named Mike Galizio. Remarkably. The RAND Institute does a lot of independent analysis of issues. They estimate that a strong third-party doctrine would add from 11% to 19% to the average cost of auto insurance in a state. Your statute actually goes beyond strong because it is coupled with this class action provision, this one-sided attorney's fee in the class action area, this ability to pend any action while you've got a complaint over at the Oregon Department of Insurance. And then once that comes out, if they found if this behavior by an insurer was violating, that can be prima facie evidence of a violation in the second lawsuit. And the sleeper in this draft bill before you is that actions are not actionable until discovered.
which means independent of when they actually occurred chronologically, when it first comes to light to somebody that they felt they were mistreated, that's when it's actionable. I see that as operating in tandem with the class action provision. Once you run your first claim through the department, you get the finding, this prima facie evidence, now you can pull for additional claims. What you will see in that handout is that the effect of this doctrine in California was to dramatically escalate the frequency of claims, dramatic in California, auto claims, dramatically escalate the severity of claims. You will actually see a bell-shaped curve. All of these curves peak when the second lawsuit doctrine was thrown out in California. So severity went up, frequency went up, the volume of claims in the state court system soared dramatically, The nutshell is that the experience of many jurisdictions that have looked at it, and again, it's in RAND, it's in the state court's own studies, and it's in the West Virginia courts, is that the second lawsuit doctrine leads to increased claims, increased expense, a lot of burden on the courts. I'll stop right there.
And it's been repealed in both jurisdictions.
Yes, it's been repealed in both jurisdictions. In fact, in California, it was on the books. The court threw it out in 1988. It was passed in 1999, and the voters, by almost 3-1, rejected it in March 2000.
And thank you very much. Yeah, and you've used up the 2 minutes for everybody in this room, I think, at this point. But it was really important to hear what you had to say, and I appreciate you coming up from Sacramento to give us your testimony. Really
thank
do.
You, sir.
Mr. Chairman, the other packet is a list of about 16 or 18 other businesses and entities who oppose the bill as well.
Thank you. Thank you. We got that. Mr. Merle, I don't know if you wanted to say anything.
No, Chair Holby, I was only here in case you had questions. So.
Thank you for that. Thank you. Representative Gilliam, did you have something to say?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Because of the experience that was just testified to in California and costs and clogging and so forth, I made the first request I've ever made to legislative fiscal to get some information about the California situation for us to.
Thank you for that.
Here's the problem that I ran into. They won't give it to me unless, as they reported this to me today, unless we move to a work session.
I
don't know if you can help me with that or what your advice is. Because I think
you can't help you with that, I don't think. So I appreciate that comments, and we'll talk more about that as and if we progress.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate that. I've just got a couple more minutes left, but J.L. Wilson, Mr. Dorrigan, and Bill Syme. If you can come up, you've got a minute apiece.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing the National Federation of Independent Business. I'll be brief. We oppose the bill. I'll submit written testimony to outline our reasons. But there's empirical evidence, not only in West Virginia, California, the RAND study, that all suggests that this is a costly measure for small business, and that's why we oppose it.
Thank you for that, Mr. Wilson.
For the record, Representative Hopley, my name is Jim Dorrigan. I'm CEO of Northwest Physicians Mutual, their physicians insurance company. We insure about 35% of the physicians practicing in the state of Oregon. And we've all seen malpractice insurance as being a problem area, but this bill in particular would cause problems in the malpractice area in a number of areas. One, over the last 3 years, we've seen frequency decline in the state because of the efforts of physicians on the patient safety side in hospitals. We think that that would undo that reduction in claims. Secondly, it creates a conflict of interest for us in defending our insureds, in that we're defending against malpractice actions. We would also have to be considering the interest of the injured third party in the case as opposed to defending the case. It would drive up the costs of the cases going forward in terms of the settlements, and also we feel it would increase the number of cases. Finally, Oregon is still a crisis state according to the AMA, and we're having trouble with physician recruitment. We feel that this would further increase the cost of insurance, decrease the availability, and further exacerbate the physician shortage problem in the state.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Simon, if you want to say something in about 30 seconds, I'd really appreciate it, and I apologize for the shortness of time.
I'm going to write you a really good letter that explains all the reasons why our organization, the Oregon Association,
we do take written testimony.
Yes, I understand it. We oppose the bill. This is a bill that came before the legislature in the early 1980s.
Could you identify yourself, please, for the record?
Yes, Bill Syme, here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel.
Thank you.
Okay. Beginning in the early 1980s, this bill first came for the legislature at least three or four times. It was a bad idea then. It is a bad idea now. And I'll give you some further testimony as to why.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And again, apologize for the shortness. But look, do encourage you to submit your written testimony. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3075. And the House Committee on Consumer Protection is adjourned.